From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Celebrated psychologist Andrew Solomon is known for his books Far From the Tree and The Noonday Demon on unusual children and depression, human interior life. But that's not all he's written. Solomon is a world-class traveler and writer on travel and events abroad. His new book is Far and Away. It looks back at those stories and experiences from Moscow to Libya to Afghanistan and beyond. Solomon says travel matters if we're going to understand the world and each other. More of us, he says, need to get out there. This hour on Point, we're traveling with Andrew Solomon. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are Americans hesitant to really go out, get out there into the world these days? Will we ever get it if we don't? Joining me now from New York is Andrew Solomon, professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center, author of the books Far From the Tree, The Noonday Demon. His new book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. Leslie Jamieson calls it an ecstatic provocation to understand ourselves not as citizens of nations, but as citizens of the entire world. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Solomon, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. What a pleasure to be back.
Can you just clarify for us? We think of you sitting around as a psychologist and looking into families and minds and psychologies and maybe with a smoking a pipe next to a, I don't know, a couch we should lie down on. And here you are all over the world. Make sense of your life for those of us who just know you through Far From the Tree and The Noonday Demon. Where did all this 25 years of incredible travel writing and reporting come from?
Well, making sense of my whole life might be a steep task to accomplish in a few sentences on radio.
Yes.
But I started off really doing international reporting. I was very interested in the larger world. I was interested in otherness. I was interested in the ways that we do or don't understand places that are far away, and I really like to travel. And for many years, my focus really was international reporting. And then as I dealt with my own depression, I wrote about depression, it led me into the other books that you've mentioned. But my passion for knowing and exploring and engaging with the world remained very acute. And the urgency of doing that seemed to get greater and greater as it seemed to me that the attitude in this country in many instances became narrower.
Some of this travel is personal travel. Some of this travel is frankly kind of luxury or a lifestyle travel. And a lot of it is very gritty reporting where you're right out there. So what made the difference? Were you traveling for fun and writing about it sometimes? Others on assignment for news organizations? What's the range of writs you took out into the world?
In the time right after I finished graduate school, mm-hmm. I had a job writing for a British glossy magazine, and I was writing their arts and auctions coverage. And Sotheby's was having an auction in Moscow of contemporary Soviet art. And my interest really was not particularly in the art. It was in writing a kind of lampooning piece about all of the people who were jet-setting out to Moscow for this event, selling this clearly terrible painting and sculpture. And then I was in Moscow, and I began to get to know the artists, and I understood that their work was full of encoded meanings, that they had intended it to show to one another because there were no other possibilities in the late Soviet period, mm-hmm. and that if you understood what was going on, it was profound and moving and beautiful. And that was the beginning of my thinking. We read the news reports of these places. We hear what they're supposed to be like. It bears no relationship to the reality, which is that there is a level of intelligent engagement going on pretty much every place.
There's political reporting here. There's arts reporting here. There's very personal reporting. Some of this people may have read in The Noonday Demon about your own struggle with depression. There's a kind of incredible piece out of that you wrote for or published in Esquire. Headline, Naked, Covered in Ram's Blood, Drinking a Coke and Feeling Pretty Good. You're in Senegal learning about a tribal ritual called Ndup, which is used to treat depression, I guess. And you yourself had suffered at that point. You agree to have one of these ceremonies performed on you. I hope you'll read for us in a second, but we found online a little chanting from this healing ritual from a village in Senegal. My guest, Andrew Solomon, goes through this ritual to address his own depression. Let's just listen. It puts us there a little bit. Andrew, can you set the stage for us and read just a bit from your account of having gone through this ceremony?
The entire village had taken the day off from their work in the field, and they were dancing around the ram and me in concentric circles. As they danced, they threw blankets and sheets of cloth over us, so we were gradually being buried. It was unbelievably hot and completely stifling. Along with the sound of these stamping feet as everyone danced around us, the drums got louder and louder and more ecstatic. I thought I was just about to faint or pass out. At that key moment, all of the cloths were suddenly lifted. I was yanked to my feet. The villagers pulled off the loincloth that was all I was wearing. The poor old ram's throat was slit, as were the throats of the two cockerels. Madame Diouf and her assistants plunged their hands into the blood of the freshly slaughtered ram and cockerels and rubbed it over my entire body. It had to cover every inch of me. They rubbed it through my hair and across my face and over my genitals and on the bottoms of my feet. It was warm, and when the semi-coagulated parts were smooshed over me, the experience was peculiarly pleasurable. So there I was, naked, totally covered in blood, and they said, "Okay, that's the end of this part of it. The next part comes now." And I said, "Okay." And we went back over to the area where we had done the morning preparations. One of them said, "Look, it's lunchtime. Why don't we just take a break for a minute? Would you like a Coke?" I don't drink Coke that much, but at that moment it seemed like a really, really good idea. So I sat there, naked and completely covered in animal blood, with flies gathering all over me, as they will when you're naked and covered in animal blood. And I drank my Coke.
Andrew Solomon reading from his essay, reporting naked, covered in ram's blood, drinking a Coke and feeling pretty good. That's traveling. That's way out there. The next thing you know, they're tying you up with the intestines from that ram hanging from a tree, and you're tied in ram's intestines. This is not exactly a weekend in Cancun.
It is not exactly a weekend in Cancun. But part of my point in the book is that we make this big distinction between travelers and tourists. And obviously having an exorcism means you're a traveler and you've engaged with the culture. Mm. And tourists just go to look at it. I don't really believe that anyone does just one without the other. Mm-hmm. I think most travelers are at some level thinking, as I was thinking, boy, I'm going to be living off this story for the rest of my life. And that even people who are tourists, just by going to a different place, have to pick up a little bit of understanding of the difference that that place entails. So I'm a big believer in the idea that you don't have to separate out travel stories and tourism stories, but that you can rather just have all of them and say, these are the ways I've engaged with the world. And that day in Senegal, boy, did I feel like I'd engaged with the world.
Yes, blood head to toe, including the bottoms of the feet. We're going to dive into a lot of these stories. You make the point throughout here, looking back over 25 years of travel, that there's an importance to this that's beyond pleasure. There's an importance, you actually call it a moral imperative, that people get out and travel if they can, if they have the means. That's kind of high framing for travel. I think we may intuitively understand why you put it in those terms, but you tell us.
I really believe that if every young adult in the world were required to spend 2 weeks in another country, doesn't matter what other country, doesn't matter what they were doing there, that half the world's diplomatic problems would be solved. People's lack of understanding of places that are far away or foreign or different creates anxiety and fear, and anxiety and fear create hostility, and hostility often erupts in war and violence. And while I didn't plan this book to come out during this election season, as I look at some of the debate that's going on about walling people out and closing down immigration and all of these cruelties visited on people, I'm struck over and over again by how narrow that point of view is. Alexander von Humboldt, the great philosopher, German philosopher of a couple of hundred years ago, said, "There is no worldview as dangerous as the view of those who have not seen the world." And I think it's true. To have a worldview, you need perhaps to engage through my book and perhaps to go yourself in 3D, but somehow or other to recognize the humanity of other people and see what are the ways in which we're all the same and what are the ways in which actually we're a bit different from one another.
Now, look, not everybody has the means or corollary, perhaps the time, but many do. And I have the sense, having been the kind who traveled very early and very widely and spent 10 years abroad, I have a sense that Americans are traveling less in meaningful ways than they might have a generation ago. I don't know if it's post 9/11 or if it's economic distress or if it's just kind of an intellectual retreat. Do you share that?
I do share that. I think it's because people have been made more and more frightened. I mean, I think 9/11 had a lot to do with it. 9/11 gave people the idea that the rest of the world was out to destroy us and that if we went there, we were putting ourselves in danger. But I'll tell you something that was very striking to me when I was in Libya, and this is about traveling in rather than out, but I think it connects nonetheless. At that point, there was a big debate going on in Gaddafi's government about whether to liberalize and open to the West or to keep the country and the economy and the whole system completely closed and separatist. And every government official I met who wanted to engage with the West had studied in the US or the UK. And every government official I met who didn't want to open up and expand things had not traveled and had not been to the US or the UK. And I thought it's very hard to love a place that you've never been. And we have the idea that we're creating security by keeping people out. You actually create more security if you allow the people who might love your place to come to it. And on the flip side, and back more specifically to your question, it is by going to other places that you are able to love them and deal with them humanely. It's by traveling and seeing other countries and recognizing what they're like that you get to the point at which you can say, these are some people we need to help. These are some people we might love. And frankly, so that you can say in a more informed way, these people are a real problem and these are the enemies.
Andrew Solomon. His new book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. He says there's a moral imperative to get out and travel, see, learn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer, traveler, famed psychologist, cultural explorer, Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, about travel and the moral imperative, he says, to get out, if you can, and see the world, understand the world, and how different it may be from your own life at home. His new book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. Lots of reporting on arts, on politics, on personal experience. You just heard some there, him smeared in ram's blood and drinking a Coke in Senegal when he was looking to get over his own depression. You can join us this hour. Does Andrew Solomon's assertion here about this moral imperative to travel, does it resonate with you that there's almost an obligation to get out and travel, see the world beyond your own domain? What would our world look like if everybody, millions more, really got out there, if they could, and saw the rest of it? Might our foreign policy change? Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, The Noonday Demon, professor of clinical psychology at Columbia Medical Center. But boy, has he been out there. Joins us today from New York. And Andrew, callers many for you already. Denise in Colorado, Fort Collins, Colorado. You're on with Andrew in New York.
Oh, hello, Andrew. It's so great to talk to you and hear what you have to say.
Thank you.
My husband and I just got returned from Southeast Asia. We spent almost six months there, traveling in namely Vietnam, far north Vietnam, central Vietnam, in southern, over into Cambodia and Laos. And we found an incredible acceptance of ourselves, above and beyond what we expected after hearing from our friends how much danger we were putting ourselves in by going there.
What do you take from that, Denise? What do you take from it? Did it change your sense of the world?
Absolutely. I mean, we've traveled before in third world countries, but this particular trip was very poignant because we had some people we knew in northern Vietnam, students that we'd met at CSU, and we went to see them, and from there, it just blossomed. We started to, you know, teach English in the evenings, and it wasn't something we had prior volunteered for. It just kind of happened in places where there wasn't English. The English teachers would always find us, and we'd end up teaching everything from, you know, preschool all the way up through high school, and I can't describe the faces of those children and how they appreciate us being there.
Denise, I so appreciate your call. Andrew, respond here. They'd been warned or that, you know, maybe it'd be dangerous. There can be fear out there when people think about going out and digging in. You've gone out and dug in lots of settings.
What about that fear? What would you say to Americans listening right now thinking, well, you know, club, you know, Cabo's fine. I don't need to go further than that.
Well, I think that there is some risk sometimes to traveling to faraway places, though I think there's also a lot of risk to driving on a major superhighway and people just go ahead and do it anyway to get where they want to go. I think you should travel prudently and with a sense of what risks you're open to and what risks you aren't. But I think often people think that they're going to a place where they're going to be attacked and brutalized, and they have the experience that Denise just described of actually being welcomed and embraced. When I was in Afghanistan during the invasion in February of 2002, I went one day, I had bought a hat, an Afghan hat, and I was walking back through a crowded market with my translator. And at that point, there were very few Americans there, and the ones who were there were mostly UN or military and couldn't go out into public mixing places. And as we walked through that market, Farouk said to me, "Why don't you put on your hat?" And I said, "Oh, Farouk, I think it looks a little silly, kind of going native, I don't know." And he said, "No, come on, please put on the hat." So I said, "Okay." And I put on the hat, and all of a sudden, everyone around us burst into applause. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. And one man stepped forward, and he embraced me, and he said, "You are a foreigner, you are an American, but you are in our country, you are walking with us in this market, you are wearing a traditional Afghan hat in exactly the right way. We want you to know that you are welcome here." And I have to say, a lot of the time, I've had those extraordinary experiences of being embraced even in the places that seemed most frightening. Now, that's not to say there was no danger then in being in Afghanistan or to send all of the listeners off to travel to Kabul next week, but only to say that I think there can be risk, but there can be a great deal of joy if you're able to tolerate that risk.
John in Miami, you're on with Andrew in New York.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for accepting my call. This subject is super interesting to me, and I really appreciate Mr. Solomon's premise and research into this topic. I believe that as human beings, we have an instinctual fear of the other and those who are different from us, and I feel that travel can definitely help to break down those personal barriers we may have. I'm 24 years old, and I had the amazing privilege to go to Japan last year. And I went to Tokyo, to Kyoto, to Kamakura. And when I travel, I really make it a point to immerse myself into the culture, commute, shop, eat like the locals do. I was only there for a week, but there was something very grounding about it. I believe that traveling and giving ourselves those opportunities to immerse ourselves in other cultures grounds us and maybe helps us to rethink our own culture. And I think as human beings, we also tend to think that our way is the only way and our way is the best way. Being in Japan, it's completely different from American culture. I was born in America. I'm an American citizen. And it was just entirely different. And it made me rethink the norms we have in America. Not that American culture is negative in any way, but as with any culture, there are aspects to any culture that are imperfect.
Sure.
It was definitely a very grounding, amazing learning experience to be in Asia and in Japan, which my family's from Peru and from China and from Scotland and Italy, but I've only been to Peru.
Okay.
I am the Olympics.
Yeah.
So I've only been to Peru. Being in Asia was a completely different experience. It was great.
What a great American mix you've got there in your family background. And I'm so glad you brought up this issue of the other and finding comfort with it. I mean, Andrew Solomon, perhaps this is where your role as a psychologist and traveler intersect. And help us think about what it means to come to terms with the reality that some other people may look at the world in quite a deeply different way and how that can resonate out through a person's own life, but also all the way maybe into national foreign policy.
Well, I'll start by saying that some people have suggested a discontinuity between my previous books and this one. But I think they've all been about exploring otherness and exploring difference. Mm-hmm. And they all to some extent draw on my childhood, on growing up as a gay person, on the sense of being external that I have. I said in the book that in some ways, having always felt a little bit different from everyone, it was kind of a relief to go to foreign places where I was obviously different from everyone.
And you said you grew up being quite afraid of the idea of going abroad.
I was very afraid of the idea of going – you know, I wasn't afraid of going, as you said, to Cabo, but I was afraid of engaging in the way that I did. But I think that travel is both a window and a mirror, which is to say that on the one hand, when you travel, you encounter a lot of otherness and you get used to it and you see things that you would never have been able to see if you stayed home. That's the window part. But also, a lot of things about you that seem relevant when you're at home kind of fall away when you're abroad and people don't know your contacts, they don't know your socioeconomic group, they don't know what your accent means or what the implications are of where you live or any of those things. You kind of end up seeing yourself with an incredible and often very poignant clarity through the eyes of other people. And I think both the window piece of it and the mirror piece of it are very valuable. And the caller we've just spoken to was really describing going to Japan and seeing Japan, but also coming to see himself clearly. And that's one of the reasons for engaging with the world, is for that self-knowledge.
I mean, if people gain that, I mean, you're pretty tough-headed at other points here. You say don't expect the world to break out in kumbaya. That's not exactly what you're picturing.
Well, look, I've gone into a lot of war zones, and I've met a lot of people who were suffering terribly, and I would never want to discount the suffering that they were experiencing. What I would say overall, though, is that often the places I visited were going through a moment of transition into hope. Now, some of those places got very hopeful, and then their hopes were all dashed. And some of those places got very hopeful, and then things actually did get better. But there is a kind of headiness in that moment of transformation, in that feeling of hope when it comes up to the surface. And I spoke recently with an artist I know from Moscow, and we were talking about all of the hopes we'd once had that had been frustrated. And he said, even if none of what we hoped for came true, he said, that moment of hope, like a happy childhood, is a thing that will stay with me forever and that affects every decision I make in my life. And if you have the opportunity to bear witness to that hope, that's great. And then, of course, you also end up bearing witness to a great deal of despair, because so much goes awry and so much turns out differently than how people had hoped it would.
One of those moments of hope and change abroad was back in 1991. A group and the Communist Party and the old Soviet Union attempted to take control from Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. The coup d'etat attempted failed days later when Boris Yeltsin, a citizen of Moscow, stepped in opposition to the coup. But Gorbachev resigned later that year. Andrew Solomon was there. He'll read for us in just a second. But here's just a sound of reporting from that time. Reporter Simon Marks was there for World Monitor.
Mingling with the rush hour traffic, Red Army armored personnel carriers on the streets of Moscow this morning, heading to the Kremlin. They first moved in at 4 a.m., the first sign of the coup d'etat that removed Mikhail Gorbachev from power.
It would get very dramatic before it was all over. Andrew Solomon was there. There's a piece, 3 days in August, you wrote for the New York Times Magazine. You're visiting friends in Moscow in 1991. You hear that apparently Gorbachev has resigned. It would later come out that a coup had been staged. You found yourself in the streets of Moscow alongside your friends and many citizens of the city. And there's a remarkable moment that you describe in Far and Away. I don't know if you want to set that up any further, but I hope you'll get to the reading.
I will get to the reading. And I'll just say that I was with all of the artists and intellectuals I had been interviewing in Moscow, that they all helped to organize the resistance to the coup, which was the coup in which Yeltsin ultimately took over and the next phase of Russian history began, and that they brought me along with them. This is from the third day. A young man who looks like some early Bolshevik or like the student from a Chekhov play, unshaven, wire-rimmed spectacles, crumpled cap held in a tense, pale hand, comes running from the barricade. He announces through a megaphone that tanks are approaching and asks for volunteers to come and stop them. Without discussion, we all follow him to the outer limit of the many-tiered system of defenses we have built and range ourselves along it. We are prepared for anything, though there have been so many rumors of tanks that none of us really expects to see one. In fact, they arrive within minutes. I am petrified. Facing down tanks has not previously been a part of my job description. But I am also exhilarated by the intense purposefulness of our stance. I have never before had to defend my ideals this way, and though doing so in this instance is frightening, it also feels like a privilege. there is something oddly romantic about our encounter with brutality. The soldier in the first tank explains they have come to destroy the barricade and orders us to move, adding that they will have to run us down if we do not give way. The man with the megaphone responds that we are holding our ground, not in aggression, but to defend the rights of the people. We are only a few, but there are tens of thousands at this parliament and across all the country, he says. He speaks of democracy and reminds the young men in their tanks of the terrors of the past. If you do this, it is because you have chosen to do it, says the man with the megaphone. The soldiers look at one another, and then they look at us. We are so wet, so cold, so impotent in all but the courage of our convictions, so entirely persuaded that we speak in the name of righteousness, but so transparently lacking in material defenses, that the soldiers might easily laugh. Instead, after staring at us intensely for a full minute, the driver of the front tank shrugs, as though he were doing nothing more than giving way to the inevitable course of destiny. We must bow to the will of the people, he says, and instructs us to move aside so the tanks can make U-turns.
Andrew Solomon reading from Far and Away. There you are, right in the thick of it, in 1991 in Moscow. When you look out at Russia now and everything going on there, does that still inform your view? Does it inform how you look at Putin and everything we hear and the reporting coming out of Russia now, all these years later?
Well, I think it's terrible to see what has happened in Russia and how much freedoms have been eroded. As I said, mm-hmm. sometimes the changes aren't essentially as much for the better as they seem to be at the time. That was a moment of glorious liberation. But as I said, I think that that feeling of hope actually still exists at some subtle level in Russia. I think Russia is a country in which optimism has always felt fragile. I mean, they went through the domination of the Tsar. They went through Stalin and his purges and killing a large part of the population. They've gone through all of these different phases. I still look at Russia and I think it's a place where ideals have a role to play. I had grown up thinking, oh, I would like to be able to write clearly and well and thereby shift the direction of history, but knowing that that was a ridiculous idea and that the best I could hope for was to entertain a few readers. That day, facing down those tanks, the reason they turned around was because people could articulate so clearly what the fabric of democracy was in a way that those of us who live in a democracy mostly couldn't. And it was the beauty of their words and the urgency with which they expressed them that turned those tanks around. And that was the day the coup failed, not because of that one episode, but for many other reasons, but in part because of episodes like that. So when I look at Russia now, the government is oppressive and evil and has done demonic things. But I still think that within the people, there's a little bit of that optimistic poetry. And so I'm not cynical about the long-term experience in Russia, even though I'm cynical about the current government.
And you were there at that moment to witness it. And that witness still informs the way you see it.
It does.
Andrew Solomon's new book is Far and Away. Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years, terrific collection of travel reporting and writing. Andrew, lots of callers for you. Jenny in Providence, Rhode Island. Jenny, you're on the air with Andrew Solomon in New York.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I'm calling in because I spent almost a year riding my bicycle through Central and South America. And when I was in Ecuador, I was actually kidnapped. And I returned home for about a month from the trip and underwent intensive therapy and then returned back to the trip. I had lots of friends and family discouraging me from going. And I'm so glad I returned. And I felt just so overwhelmed by how 99.9% of my time spent traveling. I was welcomed with open arms into people's homes and given meals. And that we have to remember to identify individuals who commit heinous crimes and not countries and not towns and cities.
Jenny, how long were you held, Jenny? Were you ransomed or what happened?
I was not ransomed. I was held for 24 hours, and they stole everything we had, and then they let us go. They blindfolded us and kind of dumped us in the middle of a neighborhood, a slum, and I was kidnapped with one other female, and we kind of stumbled our way back to the people we were traveling with.
But you came home, recovered, and went right back to it. Is that your advice?
Yes. I think that we just have to remember that, you know, the majority of people are good, and to not let one person and one incident kind of shape your worldview of a country or, you know, an entire continent.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. Andrew, you have your own experiences with some pretty rough stuff along the way. There's Jenny's, you know, kidnapped for a day, but back to it.
Well, first I want to say, Jenny, that I admire your courage. I admire your stamina. And most of all, I admire your having the ability that I think has been so lacking from American political discourse lately to say the fact that some people in a particular place dealt with me in an aggressive, horrifying fashion doesn't mean that's a whole country of aggressive, horrifying people. It may mean the policing isn't as good as it should be. It does not forgive the experience, but it recognizes that you can't universalize from it, which is the mistake that I think people have so often made in the arguments currently going on about America and its foreign policy in the world. Oddly enough, and I've written about this in the book, I too was kidnapped in Ecuador, though in my case only for 3 or 4 hours, but in not wholly dissimilar circumstances. And it was an incredibly disturbing and upsetting and horrifying experience at the time. One of the things that I would say is if you're going to travel wisely. Try to know what you're doing. Try to know what the context is you're going into. Try to find people you can trust. That isn't a certain safeguard, but it will safeguard you a lot of the time. I think there is some danger you can expose yourself to. I also think, though, that there's a danger in cutting yourself off from the rest of the world. I think it's a way to make yourself lonely and narrow-minded. And sometimes I think if you can break through that danger by going someplace, or at the very least by reading about other people's experiences going to places, that's a way to break through that particular loneliness.
Jenny, we're glad you're out the other side and back to it, or were. Will in Charlottesville, Virginia. Will, you're on with Andrew Solomon.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree with Andrew that travel is the very best antidote to xenophobia. I met my wife nearly 50 years ago now, and we were both hitchhiking around Europe and the Middle East. And one point I wanted to make was I was only able to take £50 out of Britain at that time because of currency restrictions, and it had to last for 6 months. So we were traveling
on a shoestring, and you did it.
In all kinds of places, beaches, ditches, all over, and very cheap hotels. And money is a great insulator. If you go from Hilton to Hilton, you might as well not travel. But if you're traveling in cheaper hotels and meeting people all the time, that is wonderful.
You know, John Ruskin, the great Victorian traveler, once said about the train service that had been put in, he said, "It is not like traveling at all, but merely like being sent from place to place like a parcel." Which I thought was a wonderful response to that. I think you can stay in a nice hotel if you can afford to and you want to, or you can sort of sleep in a ditch if you're up for that and that's the best way forward. I think the real thing, which you've just said, is to engage with local people and to get a sense of their way of life. You know, when I was growing up, I did a certain amount of travel with my parents. My father had business that was abroad, and we sometimes had to go to places. But I felt like we went and we looked at the place. We were not part of the place. I think the mission, and it's not so easy to do, but it's also not so difficult to do, not nearly as difficult as you'd think, is to go someplace and be in that place so that you don't effectively have the same experience you would have had seeing the place represented on a TV screen, but instead feel like you've engaged with and interacted with the place. And there are people almost every place who would like to engage and interact with you. Now, you have to be careful which ones you engage and interact with because you don't want to end up kidnapped in Ecuador if you can avoid it. But I think that process of opening up to people – and, you know, when you are traveling, you need help from other people the whole time. But also when you're traveling, you can often help other people. If you want to find a route to intimacy with a place, mm-hmm. go there and do something kind for someone. It can just be helping them across the street, and suddenly you're woven into the fabric of the society.
You know, a story like that, and I think it dovetails with Will's observation about traveling on the cheap. I was 19 or 20, just arrived in India, would be spending a year there, on the Grand Trunk Railway, headed down right through the belly of the country. Second day, I'm just a kid, you know, and a desperate-looking man comes up and gestures me to come a few cars back in the train, thrusts me through the door of a women's compartment, and it is clear that his wife is lying there, and she's having a baby, and he wants me to do something to deliver the baby. I grew up, you know, maybe delivering lambs on the farm, but a baby, I mean, it's a long story, and it turns out they found an Indian doctor who took care of everything, but talk about, you know, being out there in the midst of it. It was being in that third class car, not up in an air conditioned, you know, perfection place up front, that made all that more likely to happen, and maybe kindness going both ways. Ron in Miami, you're on with Andrew Solomon.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
And the beautiful piece of writing, Andrew, about your experience in Russia. I thought that was wonderful.
Thank you.
So I listened to what you said, and I have to agree. I had started traveling very, very early in life. I was born on the Mexican border, and I was exposed to at least the northern culture of Mexico, learned Spanish. I think your premise that traveling is a moral obligation to gain perspective, I couldn't agree more. And just to give some perspective and put it in context, I had joined the Navy when I was 16, went in 17. On my 3 weeks after my 19th birthday, I had landed in Antarctica, which was my seventh continent. I even have a picture of it. I've traveled to over 100 countries, and I've done it in a way that mentors in the Navy and in business had showed me how to travel, what to do, and that perspective gained me a lot rather than going as a tourist. And in that respect, also traveling through the U.S., I've noticed that even the U.S. is not a singular culture. It's over a dozen primary, almost civilizations that kind of get together and work as one. Cultures here, same thing in Mexico, same thing in Argentina, same thing in India, same place, same thing everywhere. And having gone down to the micro level, it seems that I had experienced it a lot different than people that I was with. Even being in the Philippines, I watched a child, couldn't have been 11, 12 years old. He was playing a guitar. He was playing Eddie Van Halen, Eruption, to perfection. And I was watching him thinking, he's so talented. If he was in the U.S., he would be successful. But he's here. He doesn't have a chance, so this is his life. While the two friends I was with just wanted another beer and thought he was some guy picking rice. So,
right out there to get the nuance of it, Ron. And there you were. The Navy's a good start on all that. When you hear it, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more for Andrew right here. Barbara in New York, Endicott, New York. Barbara, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My story is that I was a traveler by accident, not a tourist, but because I spent 3 months down in Arizona, Sonoita, I spent a lot of time in the court in Nogales. Prior to this, when I was a kid, my parents had taken me across the border to Nogales, where guys were on the streets offering to meet, if you might want to meet my sister and things like that. And I had a horrible...
You're talking pimping or prostitution there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I had a really bad attitude. Add that to some of the Hollywood depiction of Mexico. I had a pretty bad attitude about it. Well, I got corrected because my sister died at age 62. It was a wrongful death that I could not prosecute. But I was the only one left in my family, so I went down there alone. And there were two wills. The one will left everything to her husband. Unfortunately, her husband had a guardian, some long-lost nephew that I'd never met. And so everything of my sister's was going to that guardian.
What's the travel angle here, Barbara? Help us to it. Take us to it.
Oh, the angle? Okay. Well, that's just the history. She had a holographic will. By law, I to carry out my sister's last wishes out of respect, I took it to court, leaving everything to the church, me and the SPCA.
Barbara, take us to the travel angle right here. What is it? What's the bottom line?
Oh, I'm sorry. My cheerleaders were the Mexicans. When I told anybody, the grocery checkout guy or anything, because I was there for 3 months, he would stop, he would hug me, and it was heartfelt. I can sense the difference.
Did it change your attitude about Mexico?
Completely. And I had this whole support team of Mexicans. They believed in my purpose. They believed in justice. They believed in carrying out the last wishes of my sister, as opposed to the white men, with the exception of one, who would discourage me and tell me I'm wasting my time.
Barbara, we've got it. With that, a kind of empathetic connection right there, turning around maybe an old impression. Andrew, one of the things you write about is traveling as a gay man and how that has colored or brought subtleties to your experience of traveling abroad. Share some of that perspective with us.
Well, I think that as a gay person, I had long had a sense that I was looking in at my own society, and going into other societies was a way to do it. It also gave me a network. You know, I go someplace and I see what gay life is like there, and it gives me a kind of standard of comparison, a particular intimacy. Some of the time, it's been very inspiring. Some of the time, it's gone in very weird directions. Mm-hmm. When I was in Ghana, I was at a wedding and befriended a Ghanaian politician. He later became the vice president of Ghana. He wanted to publish a book in the U.S. I helped him to do so and was thanked in the thanks in the book. The president of Ghana died and he became the president of Ghana. And then a few months into his tenure, one of the opposition politicians, hoping to undermine his credibility, announced that John Mahama had this gay friend in New York and that I had organized the gay community in support of his campaign to be president and I had somehow figured in these various scandals. I won't go through all the details, but the upshot of it was that I've had more than 10,000 letters from Ghanaians. I've also appeared in more than 10,000 news stories there, some from gay people talking about how difficult their lives are, some from people saying that they'll slit my throat if I ever come back, but a lot from people who say, I'm not gay, but I know that the attitude in our country needs to change, and I know that you are a human being too, and you keep going with the work you're doing. So I had one which actually was my particular favorite from a woman who said, I have just divorced my fifth husband. Can you tell me how this LGBT thing works?
Maybe in the market for a different line.
Exactly. But it was really – it's been a very – enriching and sometimes heartbreaking experience. I mean, there's one gay Libyan who I got to know when I was there who finally fled Libya after three of his friends were taken into a mosque, had their hands tied behind their backs and were shot in the backs of their heads. Mm. The video of that is up on YouTube if anyone wants to search for it. He fled Libya and was in Lebanon trying to get refugee status. Eventually, he was moved to a detention facility in Slovenia, and he's now in the process of trying to become a refugee. So partly, I feel like meeting gay people and seeing what gay life is like is illuminating. But I'm also aware that the privileges I enjoy as a gay man married to my husband with children living in New York are experiences that are still unavailable in most of the rest of the world. And I think, speaking of moral imperatives, that there's a moral imperative to try to give to other people that ability. Aung San Suu Kyi, the president she's not the president, the leader of Myanmar now, once wrote a famous editorial in which she said, please use your liberty to promote ours. And I feel like, in the gay arena in particular, that's a lot of what I'm doing.
Andrew Solomon, every time you head out or look in, we learn a lot, and we do again today. I'm really glad you pulled these essays and examples of reportage together for the book. It is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. Thank you so much for being with us today, Andrew. It's just great talking with you. Thank you very much indeed.
A complete joy for me. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.